Thank you. I want you to hold a thought in your mind while I'm giving this paper. I think I might stand up at least for part of it, because I've got a crooked knee and my knee's been a bit sore. Hold in your mind the thought that came up in the exchange between Stuart and John before, the idea of a funk being based on a guitar sound that sounds like a drum. There's that image, and that may be a thought without an image, if that's, it is absolutely pertinent to the idea that I'm going to suggest in this paper about, in fact, the very nature of creation. And I think that, for me, that very notion of, you know, basing a musical form or a genre on taking one musical sound and making it sound like another musical sound is actually sums up the essence of what I'm going to talk about in this paper. All right, let me begin. Okay, it was 1963. I was 7 years old. I was sitting in the kitchen with the family at breakfast. We were listening to the radio. It was then I experienced for the first time something that much later I would understand was art. Thankfully, though, I was young enough not to be bothered by big ideas, and for that matter, even by small ones. No matter, art is always experienced long before it is understood. The experience that day at breakfast was uncanny, and the experience of the uncanny I also worked out much later is a fundamental aspect of aesthetics. It's one of the key things that translate human expression into art. That day at breakfast, I would experience something uncanny, and it would stick with me for the rest of my life. I remember it today as though it was yesterday. For a young boy growing up in central Queensland, radio in 1963 was astonishingly boring. The words saccharine, sentimental, banal and vacuous don't begin to describe it. Even as a seven-year-old, I knew that this dreary radio fodder was forgettable in the extreme. Then it happened. I heard a sound that I had never heard before. It shattered the viscous envelope of tedium that radio seemed to wrap everything in. It was the sound of a harmonica that was otherworldly. It came from another, better place. What I didn't know then, but what I know now, is that I was hearing the sound of art for the first time. Certainly for the first time I was aware of. There was something strange and beautiful about that sound. I couldn't say at the time what it was, but it left its mark on me. It was memorable in a way that almost all of the sounds of the radio at that time were not. What I later came to understand was that this was also a mark of art. Art is memorable. The way that it makes an impression on the mind sets it apart from other forms of human expression. We remember each incident of art long after it has happened. It sticks in our mind, the rest we forget. The song I heard was a beat song. I don't think the radio announcer liked it very much. The radio sound of the time was an anodyne archaeology of the 1940s, 50s and early 60s. The popular songs of the period were by turns pedestrian and corny. This beat song was different. It stood out. Actually, it was less the song than its harmonica riff that was difficult to forget. The radio usually induced amnesia. This sound demanded to be memorized. It sank its teeth into the listener's cerebral cortex and would not let go. The seven-year-old thought to himself, this is terrific. I was not the only one who was affected in this way by Love Me Do. Many musicians, decades later, talked about the lasting impression that that song made on them. The song itself was not a great Lennon and McCartney composition. It had been written in 1958 and was a team piece by precocious talents. But Lennon's harmonica playing on the 1962 recording turned the song into something else, into art. That begs the question then, what is art? And what was it about Lennon's playing that could turn a standard period beat song into a work with aesthetic qualities? Let me telegraph the answer to that question by saying that art and aesthetics are a function of the double act of creation. What Lennon's playing, the Lennon-McCartney partnership, and art in general have in common is the uncanny double dominated by the slightly eerie, strange, or mysterious character of two things that are one. This peculiar two-in-one effect pervades art. It is a cause of aesthetic experience. It lies at the core of the cognitive act of creation, and it deeply influences the way in which we recognise artworks. It does not matter whether those works are part of an official canon of art, or whether they are newly minted and everyone is uncertain of how to evaluate their significance. In 1963, the Beatles were pop radio ephemera, not durable pop art. Yet art lasts, and when a song such as Love Me Do, which in many ways is a slight song, lasts, the issue of art invariably rears its head. If 50 years has passed and the song is still played, performed, and listened to, chances are that there is something more than sloppy, slushy, gushy sentiment at the heart of its appeal. Art arouses, and the phenomenon of doubling stimulates arousal. Sitting in the soporific realm of Radioland in 1963, I was, let's face it, aroused. Art had arrived in my world. Its clarion call was John Lennon's eerie, warbling harmonica sound played on a chromatic harmonica in the key of C. The thing that made the sound memorable is the ever so slightly off-kilter effect of Lennon's vibrato playing. Vibrato is a classic art effect. It is an act of doubling, like a glissando and rubato. Interestingly, Lennon's playing echoes the history of 20th century classical string playing. Rubato technique has become a concert hall norm, had become a concert hall norm during the period. Rubato playing gives musical sound a trembling, shaking character. Harmonic players achieve the effect by the opening and closing of hands and the rapid movement of lips between the holes of the instrument. Rubato is the variation in pitch for the musical note, or in a more figurative sense, it is turning of one note into two notes simultaneously. The note is itself and something slightly different at the same time. The single note has a dual identity. And in that sense, keep in mind the comment before about the guitar sound that sounds like a drum beat. That is the point at which art becomes creative. For that is what creation is, the making of two out of one. All creation has this curious double structure. Naturally, this is not something that two bright boys from Liverpool thought much about at the time. But one does not have to have the name or the concept of something in order either to experience it or to enact it. Indeed, the humour of the two artists, Lennon and McCartney, is exactly the double nature of creation personified. Humour, joking, is the conjoining of incongruities. So also is a large part of what makes music interesting. What is harmony, but two different pitches sounded together? What is rhythm, but the joining of temporal contrasts of fast, slow, long and short? The combination of verse and bridge, words and music, semi-spoken, croon and conventional melodic singing, massed chorus and lead voice, instrumental and vocal performance, Greek melodrama with its words spoken against a vague music accompaniment, polyphonic melody lines, the overtones of notes, the intertwining of the smooth and gritty vocal grains of harmony singers, the power of music to convey the sense of near and far, or the gravitational movement up and down. One can go on endlessly in that vein. There is a big difference, though, between the latent creative syntax of music forms and their peak aesthetic deployment. The actual size of the steps from latency to potency to aesthetic realisation is enormous. Most music is not art. Indeed, most art music is not art. Art is rare. The guise it takes is often unpredictable, and it lasts. Abraham Moles calculated that all of the works that make up the standard performance repertoire in classical music are the work of 250 composers. Mozart, Bach and Beethoven each in their own right contribute about 6% of the total. Collectively, their works make up 80% of the total standard performed repertoire. Top 10 composers contribute 40% of performed works. The bottom 150 of the cohort of 200 is each represented by one work only. Collectively, the contribution of the bottom 150 is 6% of the total performed repertoire. Now, none of this is the fault of uncomprehending audiences or programmers. It is rather the expression of the fact that real artistic achievement is exceptional. To turn the latent double character of musical form into something aesthetic requires music to have the power of aesthetic arousal. Now, aesthetic arousal is collative. By collative, I mean that it is stimulated by the presence of contradictory properties, a la the James Brown. One recurring set of such properties is the alliance of novelty and familiarity, complex and simplicity, surprise and predictability, ambiguity and clarity, and variability and stability. The coincidence of these properties marks music out as art or imbues music sound with an aesthetic quality. If the music artifact falls on one side of these pairs, it's artless, and if it falls on the other side, it is phony art. The presence of contradictory properties gives rise to the quality of mystery. Mystery attends all of the great works of the absolute spirit, not least of all music. The writer and composer Jan Swofford, in a wonderful short essay in Slate magazine in 2003, reflected on Beethoven's Ninth Symphony. Swofford wondered whether the Ninth had attained the kind of ubiquity that threatened to gut any artwork. On the contrary, he concluded, great artworks can sustain ubiquity because they have the quality of mystery. We never quite ever stop figuring them out. There is always something more to be said or thought or felt about them. Swofford put it this way: everyone knows the Ninth, but has anyone understood it? The harder you look, the odder it gets. This is because it involves contradictory qualities. Swofford goes on to cite a copious number of instances of this in the work. Let me just reiterate here what he has to say about the first movement of the symphony. It is loud, bold, heroic. No, it is big and loud, all right. But Swofford points out it is also wildly unstable, searching and inconclusive. Everything heroes are not. The development section of the middle of a movement is usually a point of maximum tension and drama. Yet in this case, it is the relatively most placid of the movement. And the recapitulation of the opening theme erupts out of the calm like a scream, utilising a major chord that conventionally should signify nice and happy things, but here sounds terrifying. Swofford goes on in this vein, but the point is already made. Here we see a sublime example of the way that creation works through media that pair and unite contradictory qualities. Again, keep in mind the example of the guitar and the drum sound. On the level of form, the Ninth Symphony delivers a familiar first movement with development and recapitulation, yet also at the same time inverts the conventions of that form. In so doing, it collates familiarity and surprise, turning them into one seamless and unforgettable thing. Now, the collaboration of artists is a parallel expression of the contradictory act of creation. Collaboration in its mature shape mimics the underlying uncanny and bifurcated form of creation. Why I asked a question earlier in the day about Emily Dickinson and the parallels between collaboration of the artists and the multiple voices in the work of art, which is one can come and talk about here. It thereby gives the act of creation an existential expression, and takes creation into the complex realm of human personalities. It forces the question how things that are different become identical, and how something that is identical with its own self, be it a musical note or a human persona, can differentiate into both itself and something else at the same time. That may sound teasingly metaphysical, but it is also a basic fact of creation. Creation must do something that at first glance seems impossible. Let us consider again the specific case of Lennon and McCartney. They wrote Love Me Do together, though together actually meant separately, which is not unusual in such collaborations. The 16-year-old McCartney wrote most of the song. Lennon then added the middle eight. The whole thing has two chords and is unremarkable. It is, as I said before, Lennon's harmonica playing on the recorded version from 1962 that makes all the difference. The peak year for the pair's songwriting collaboration was 1963. There was a series of 50-50 co-compositions that year, seven songs in all. After that, their collaborative writing falls away sharply. And that drop-off indicates the paradox of collaboration. And as I talk about paradox of collaboration, you might think about poor James Brown's musicians and how they hated James Brown's guts. Here we come to the good side of collaboration. Collaborations are aesthetically effective because they bring artists together who are opposites in taste and temperament. Lennon and McCartney are a good example of this. Opposing natures working together conjure a union of aesthetic opposites. This is essential to creation. However, clashes in taste and temperament also destroy collaborative partnerships. There is only so long that the sardonic personality and the sentimental personality can share the same workspace. Yet if you manage to combine the sardonic and the sentimental in the same song, you may well achieve something with his art. In short, what makes collaborations work also makes them fail. She Loves You, the famous Yeah 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 song from 1963, is a matchless example of the marriage of McCartney's frothy optimism and Lennon's caustic pain. But while the cohabitation of cheeriness and hurt in melodic structures, chord patterns and lyrics is one thing, their prolonged coexistence in actual life is another. The disconnection between collaboration in art and life causes a great problem. This is because collaboration is essential to all music creation. This is true, paradoxically, as we'll see in a moment, even of acts of solo creation. Creation is a function of twinning, pairing and doubling. 20th century music is inconceivable without the partnerships of Mick Jagger and Keith Richards, Robert Plant and Jimmy Page, Igor Stravinsky and George Balanchine, John Cage and Merce Cunningham, Leone Warrick and Hal David, Frank Sinatra and Nelson Riddle, Lou Reed and John Cale, Miles Davis and Gil Evans and Elvis Costello and Steve Naive. Why are such partnerships important? Composer, orchestrator, and producer. Each one is an I, an ego. Romantic theories of creation emphasize the work of the ego alone. Thus, romantically conceived, creation is the effect of lonely geniuses. But in truth, creation is the consequence of lonely geniuses together. The interaction of I and I adds a soulful dimension to the work of the ego. It guards against the egomania and ego anxiety that otherwise destroys creative work. The strange looping that occurs between two egos, I and I, is a precondition of effective creativity. Now, even more strikingly, the strange looping between I and I sometimes occurs within a single self. The creative persona of Bob Dylan is a case in point. He has had occasional writing partnerships, notably with Jacques Levy, Sam Shepard and Robert Hunter. But mostly his is a case where the dialectic of the I and I has been internalised. His is a very clear example of a minimal self onto which has been clipped a various musical personas. These personas are impersonations of musical characters from folk blues, rhythm and blues, jazz, rock, Brechtian musical theatre, and various literary, filmic, and painterly ones as well. Out of the interaction of these various personas emerged something startlingly original. Dylan's case is as good an example of the genesis of music creation as any. Its animating force lies in the ironies of human mimesis. Human beings are a mimetic species. They copy everything in sight, not least of all each other. But out of this copying arises originality. Human beings love to act. They love to impersonate each other. They want to get up on stage because they want to be someone else. They want to put on a mask, play a role, and be a star. It is well known that shy people in particular are attracted to the stage. They clearly have a strong desire to be someone they are not. To do that, they copy others and learn roles. All human life is role-playing. All being human is performing. So in some sense, we are always who we are not. Even shy people learn to be shy. They learn the shy role before they learn to be outrageous show-offs on stage. Now the same is true of musical authorship. Composers begin by copying their music heroes. They model themselves on their predecessors. They want to be someone who they are not. Then, if they are any good, they'll find their own voice. Romantic thinkers called this voice an expression of the authentic self, one's own original self. But in fact, a creator's original self is quite unoriginal. No creative artist begins by producing a masterpiece. Almost every writer's earliest works are redundant. Prodigies included, it takes all creative artists around 10 years to develop a mature style. The creator's primary self may be idiosyncratic, but it is not original. Creators in the first instance seek out models in the hope of becoming some other self. But normally such modelling is also unoriginal. Most imitations are lame or transparent. But in a minority of cases, after a prolonged process of modelling, suddenly and often unexpectedly, a breakthrough happens. A distinctive style emerges. A writer such as Bruce Springsteen emulates musical predecessors like Roy Orbison or Bob Dylan. Springsteen's early attempts at this sound artless because they sound like copies. And then suddenly the apprentice's copies turns into masterful creations. What has happened? In works like Thunder Road or Born to Run, one can sense the presence of Orbison and Dylan, and yet in an uncanny way, such that each model has become transfigured into a simulacrum of each other. In Springsteen's classic work of the 1970s, the epic song structures of Dylan echo the melodramatic dynamics of Orbison and vice versa, in such a way that they merge ineffably. The uncanny two-in-one is realised, and in a way that is unmistakably the signature song craft of Springsteen. Dylan plays ultimate ironic testament to this in Tweeter and the Monkey Man, when he parodies himself and Springsteen in exactly the same way that Springsteen emulates Orbison and Dylan. There is a thin line that distinguishes this masterful burlesque and the act of immortal creation. And really, what this is, in fact, is a master writer showing how creation works with the wink of an eye. What distinguishes lame copying from artful creation is analogy. Analogy is the union of the same and the different. In that union lies peak creation. What the apprentice learns to do is to replicate something so that it sounds the same, even if it never does exactly, and it certainly never does immaculately. The differences between original and copy are more a result of lack of technique than anything. The journeyman, the next step up from the apprentice, learns to do something a little more sophisticated, which is to join together one emulated model together with another model. There are endless examples of journeyman creation everywhere in music. One band, Pure Reason Revolution, I recently noticed, mixes prog rock, glam, and grunge music. If nothing else, that appeals to my sense of humour. Always a good test. Just as one of the conditions of creation in science is interdisciplinary work, so the crossing over of musical genres and forms is one of the conditions of musical creation. A necessary, perhaps, but not sufficient condition. From rock operas to folk rock or country pop, musical fusion represents the meso level of creation. Thus the birds, in distinction from Bob Dylan, were distinguished journeymen, but not master artists. The difference between the two, between master and journeyman, has to do with the uncanny power of analogy. The mimetic creature, the human artist, copies. And in copying, creates what likeness, in copying creates what has likeness, something that is same and different at the same time. This is creation. But there are feeble and great creations. J.S. Bach epitomizes great creation. His contrapuntal works are a form of doubling and often quadrupling. For every melodic part in these works, there is a contrary part. The genius of the music is that these parts can be radically different in character and often seemingly indifferent to each other, and yet belong seamlessly to the same, the one piece of music. An example is all the James Brown song, and it's being put together out of parts. The structure is very similar to the nature of exactly that. And here, at that point, we sit upon the edge of creation. Each part or implied voice in Bach's deliriously beautiful toccata in D minor is an analogy of the other in the very same sense that the poet compares the human personality to a summer's day, or the pop master compares the ominous narratives of Orbison and the epical surrealism of Dylan. The greater distance between the two things compared, a distance nevertheless convincingly bridged by that very comparison, is the mark of art. In collaborative pairings, similarly, the most powerful collaborations often rest on the precarious quality of a great distance in personality or sensibility between the collaborators, whose antitheses nonetheless produce a transcendent bonding trait or value or characteristic in common. The precariousness of all of this is underlined, though, by the tenseness and explosiveness of many of these creative relationships. Dave Davies of the pop group Kinks, looking back in 2009 on one of the group's best-known songs, Waterloo Sunset, composed by his brother Ray Davies, observed that the song, this is a quote, has the counterpoint that I loved as a kid. Tune that goes up and down, like snakes and ladders. Sad, but you know it is going to explode into something good. Creative collaboration mirrors the structure of creation. It echoes something deeper about the nature of creation. The pre-Socratics, Greek philosophers, were the first to systematically describe the fact that creation invariably involves a union of opposites. They were also aware of how antagonistic this union was. We find that same union of opposites in the Oasis song, Don't Look Back in Anger. It has an indelibly memorable agonistic symmetry. The singer's melody line in the song ascends, while the guitarist's chord progression descends. More states and ladders. The aesthetic effect of the song is uncanny. Uncanny is another word for haunting. I can't get it out of my mind. I can't forget it because it interpolates a strange loop of contrariness. But this contrariness is not just structural. This is the basic point I'm making. It also mirrors the fraught musical partnership. This contrariness is not structural. It also mirrors the fraught musical partnership of the Gallagher brothers, which in turn echoes Ray Davies' lacerated partnership with his brother Dave. thinking in here of James Brown's musicians. Collaborative tension and musical differences are the flip side of the aesthetic snakes and ladders, a condition of its possibility. The gorgeous counterpoint of Brian Wilson's God Only Knows was the inverse image of the Beach Boys' internal antipathies. The great Australian demotic hymn, Throw Your Arms Around Me, spirals up out of the equally spectacular warring of the hunters and collectors. No creation without strife, as the pre-Socratic said. Yeah.
Yes, very interesting, Peter, and I agree with quite a bit of what you've said, so I'll jump straight to my disagreement. I was quite intrigued by this argument about the act of doubling and the way that opposites kind of work in the creative process, but I did feel a little bit with your paper, which I had the good fortune to read, so therefore I have an advantage over everybody else. That there was a bit of moving from the creative process to the work of art and back again. And I guess my question is, what links the process to this thing we call the musical score or the record or whatever else? And at the moment, I do feel like the thing that's connecting the two things is some kind of philosophical anthropology. Now, is there another way to think about the way that, in a sense, the process and the work relate to each other for those of us who are slightly more skeptical of philosophy with a capital P. And one possibility might be something like a historical sociology of the types of selfhood that you're talking about. Now, I'm not suggesting that culture and creativity get remade every 20 years, but what I'm kind of suggesting is that, you know, from the Middle Ages into the Renaissance, you have one model of creativity emerging, which is about rational control. Now, you mentioned Romanticism, again, another key moment in the kind of history of Western modernity. I would probably frame it a little bit different. I think Romanticism, I would interpret, rather than finding the authentic self, perhaps what Romanticism kind of captured or felt that Western culture was losing was that transcendence through loss of the self as much as anything else. So I think the notion of a journey, which you talked about, is kind of quintessentially romantic in a sense. So I guess what I'm kind of suggesting is that rather than a philosophical anthropology, you could do a kind of, I don't know, a historical sociology, for want of a better word, that still takes into account this I think you could still include the act of doubling, because the Renaissance self had an act of doubling. As much as it tried to mathematize the world and, you know, render everything in terms of science and perspective and so forth, the Renaissance is also where you have the emergence of the modern recognition of style and aesthetics, for example. In Romanticism, the doubling's probably a bit different. The loss of self leads to, I don't know, coming back to the self through other things, be it nature, be it other people, be it God, I don't know, the cosmos or something like that. So, can we avoid philosophical anthropology when talking about creativity?
Well, okay. Is this going back?
That was our thesis.
Yeah.
No. Well, like I said, I had his paper beforehand.
Yeah, it's been working out his intellectual armoury here. And that's all right. You see, the creative process is being enacted through antagonistic exchanges between those who collaborate. And he and I collaborate, and we're engaged in... You're seeing the agon of creation actually happening here before your very eyes. It's an interesting question. Well, one of the presuppositions of your question, which I might take issue with, is the degree to which the creative process is historical or not. I'm quite happy to go along with the idea that thinkers in the Renaissance had a particular account of creativity, as those of the Augustan age had a particular account, as the Romantics had a particular account, as 20th century modernism had a particular account of creativity. But now the question is whether those accounts are simply different accounts which we're able to take on board or engage with or dismiss, or whether they actually represent something about the underlying socio-historical nature of creativity in a particular period. So the argument is creativity basically essentially the same, or does it have a historical structure such that it varies from epoch to epoch, or indeed from a particular location to particular location? Is Chinese creativity different from Australian creativity, and so on? And then you get into the issue of, the account of essentialism versus relativism and so on, which are quite fascinating issues. I'm probably inclined to generally say that there are some common aspects to the creative act, most importantly here the music creative act, and that history and culture and geography and so on probably play their role too. But on the other hand, I think that there probably is a strong case to be made for that certainly at the level of peak creation, to explain peak creation, which is indicated here, is rare. It's rare whether we're talking about the history of music in its entirety or we're talking about 20th century pop music and so on. And as John indicated in the previous paper, the naive idiots, and I think there's a lot of truth in that proposition, are rare. And the moments of creation are rare, and people are never sure where they come from. But I think I'm inclined to say, and I'm happy for everybody in the room to disagree with me on this point. God forbid. Okay. That there are some, you can give a common account of creativity which is independent of history, and henceforth it's possible that one way of giving you a common account of that is through philosophical categories, but we also may use theological categories, we may use just pure aesthetic categories. I'm open to it. Doesn't have to be philosophy, and I'm kind of playing a philosophical game here, and the previous paper I think was playing a philosophical game. It's quite an interesting game, but philosophy is not necessary to explain this process, but it is a way of doing it. We had this today, we've had in the papers today, we've had psychological accounts. I mean, I find, for example, the 20th century psychology of creativity, it actually helps us explain a lot about the functioning of the creative mind, which is quite distinctive. But I don't think that's necessarily can be historicized, such that the creative psychology of Renaissance social actors are going to be different from 20th century social actors. I'm sceptical whether that's the case. But people may disagree.
I think there's always an element of zeitgeist in this, and your description at the beginning of listening to the Beatles and listening to this particular, the harmonica, I think presages what was going to happen. I mean, that there's always that part of the notion of the uncanny, which of course Freud called the unheimlich,
the unheimlich,
something which actually destabilizes you.
Yeah.
And creativity is always a sort of slightly, or in its first expression, of a destabilizing form. But I think I would agree with you that I think creativity is like the voice, and then the commentaries on creativity are like language. Language can be an enormous variety of different ways of expressing what is essentially a voice, and the voice is always the same.
No, and I'm delighted to say that I experienced the unhomely first at home.
That's where the unhomely takes place.
Yes, quite. And Freud's account's quite interesting in this process, by the way. Yeah.
Margaret has a question.
Yeah, Peter, it seems to me that your position, very interesting position, would be much more powerful if you did tie it as Eduardo suggested, to historical sociology, but also to cross-cultural ideas of creativity, because you were saying, for example, that art has to be startlingly original. Well, there are many cultures in the world, for example, in Thailand, where you're not allowed to be startlingly original. You have to respect the ancestors. I mean, originality happens. For example, if you're playing a traditional piece on the fiddle or whatever, you know, your improvisatory skills and ornamentation, etc., can be startlingly original, but not the work itself. It seems to me there are many, many, not only historical ideas of creativity, what it means, but also many cross-cultural ones. And you know, you're getting onto something here, which is very, very interesting. But maybe you should actually do what Eduardo suggests. And tie it to a picture. Maybe you're in a strong position.
Hey, let me tell you.
All that stuff about dialectics, it's all Leonard Meyer in a way. It's, you know, it's all great, but it applies to Western culture. It applies to Beethoven, it applies to the Beatles perhaps, but it doesn't apply to all cultures, and not all historical periods. The same concept of creativity can't be essentialized.
Well,
there's so much diversity in reality.
This is an interesting question, and I'm fully well aware of the explosive keg of powder that underlies the question.
No, I don't mean to be explosive. No, I'm just.
But it's fun to be.
I think you've got a lot of good points. You have there.
Can I just add one point before we move to this question up here? Just one.
Yeah.
There's another double that we're circling around, which is almost the elephant in the room, and you're kind of both pointing at it. Is that the West tends to emphasise innovation, and lots of other cultures tend to emphasise tradition. When you have a look at the West, as we've pretty well been demonstrating with these papers here all day, is that tradition in the West is equally as important as innovation. That doubling is really, really important.
Thank you for answering Margaret's question for me. That's absolutely brilliant. And I'm actually not arguing for the romantic thesis that the equation of creation and originality. I mean, in the passage where I talk about the collative qualities of creation, I'm very careful to talk about both the you know, the new and the old combined together, the familiar and the non-familiar. And in fact, one of the problems that I actually have with 20th century avant-garde definitions of art, and I think in a sense particularly the pop arts have helped actually correct this a bit in terms of the historic and cultural accounts of pop art, because I think a more sensitive than the 20th century avant-garde was in actually identifying Philip's point that tradition is a key player in this. And so I'm actually not so far removed from the Thai examples, although at the same time, if I think that what makes that where creation is at its most interesting is where there's actually a balance between the new and the old, the familiar and the innovative, and so on. And I actually think, though, that some periods of time and some cultures at some periods of time are much better at getting that balance right than others. And some traditional cultures are actually quite, stuck, and others do have the capacity to periodically produce interesting innovations.
This had to be the last one.
No.
Speaking as somebody who is much more interested in the university, truth, and cultural and historical difference.
You're my man then. I come and give you a hug. such a weird voice.
Mano and Margaret's questions. I think are symptomatic of something about what you're presenting that is kind of vertiginous, and it makes you want to, or makes me want to, and what I hear in their questions is a kind of something to hang on to. And because I'm coming from the exact different polar opposite to them in relation to your work, I want something more fundamental. Something more essential, out of what you're doing. I feel this sort of slide in between, and as I teach the doubles in comedy, and I go, we can take this double, and look, it's there, it's there, it's there, it's there, it's there. There's multiple doubles. Oh, look, there's a double under the table. Ah, ha, I see, there's one that's a double. It's not grounded enough. And I think that, sure, you could
Nobody's
ground it.
Nobody's ever said that to me.
Sure, you could ground it in social and cultural stuff, which is conventional within the humanities in the late 20th century. But I would like to ask, how would we go about looking for some sort of evolutionary, fundamental human grounding of it? Could we find that in day, night, me, not me, here, there, back, front, before, after, or some kind of categories like that? That, and could we then say that the fundament of humanity is in somehow kind of a gap that opens when a doubling is perceived? But does that ground it anymore?
I agree. I mean, I think all of those are possible things, from mythological accounts of creation through to the kind of mimesis that I was talking about in the paper, which is the human universal capacity and trait to copy. And then whenever we copy something, as an infant, we begin the world, our entry into the world, and then we start to copy. But our copies are always imperfect.
That's fine. Yeah, that's good. That's a good argument.
And what I'm suggesting with the kind of apprentice, journeyman, master kind of category is some people get really good at that imperfect copy, such that they actually turn it into something new. Now, if you want to say in 20th century Australia or something, you put the new in neon lights, and maybe in sort of other culture, in your Thai example, the new exists, but it's not necessarily put in lights. But the master musician may still be doing something that works within that gap between, here's what we inherit, oh, we copy it, we watch, Margaret's performance, and, we study that and we copy it. But then every copy we have of it is going to be a gap
that's
there.
That's
and
fine.
It's what we do with the gap.
That's fine, yeah.
Is that good?
Mm-hmm, absolutely.
Can we stop on that note?
Yeah, absolutely.
Okay.
Could we thank John and Peter for doing it? We have